Everything feels brittle, doesn't it? It's this specific kind of dry rot where the house looks okay from the curb. But you know deep down that if you leaned too hard against the wrong wall, the whole thing would just collapse. And have you noticed how nobody really trusts anyone? But we're all too exhausted to even properly be angry about it anymore. We've moved past the screaming phase and into this weird, quiet dread that we all know is there, but we just try to ignore in one way or another. There's this feeling like we're all standing on a train platform, waiting for a locomotive that's already 3 hours late. And deep down, we suspect that the tracks ended 10 miles back in a ravine or something. But we stay in the platform because we don't know what else to do. What else are you going to do? Try to go home? So there's a theory, and one that it isn't particularly comforting, but I find it pretty interesting and strangely grounding. And it says that this feeling, it isn't just a glitch or something. It isn't even really, it's not even unique. It's not unique to us. It's seasonal. And it suggests that history isn't a straight line leading towards some grand tech-heavy utopia or a sudden fiery cliff either. It's a circle or maybe a spiral. It's known as a saeculum, which is basically nature's way of saying that every 80 or so years, the collective memory of a civilization hits its expiration date. So a saeculum is roughly the length of a long human life, 80 to 90 years. And according to this concept, every 80 years, society goes through a full cycle of four seasons. Spring, summer, fall, and of course, winter. We're in winter right now. And look, I know, winter is coming, we've heard the memes. But in the context of history, winter isn't a plot point in a fantasy show. It's what's called a fourth turning. It's the season of crisis and the part where all the old rot-filled institutions finally give up the ghost so that something else, potentially better, potentially worse, but definitely different, can emerge. I don't necessarily believe that history repeats itself. I see it more like rhymes. But it rhymes while it's drunk and stumbling home from a funeral. So it's sloppy, it's repetitive, which means it usually ends with somebody crying in the kitchen or some such melodrama. Think about it. Why does everything feel like a controlled demolition right now? Why does the news feel like a fever dream written by a nihilist? Well, I mean, other than because bad news sells, the bigger picture is that we are living through, I mean, it's fairly clear, we're living through the death of an era. The winter phase, is the time when the supply of social order hits an all-time low, but the demand for it hits an all-time high. Think of it as the moment that the bill comes due for everything we ignored during the summer and the fall. Now, the thing about a crisis phase is that the movies lied to us because they told us it would be, you know, leather jackets and modified motorcycles and fighting over the last gallon of gasoline somewhere in the desert. But real life crisis is actually much more boring and much more soul crushing. It's not constant explosions and excitement. It's confusion with paperwork. Yeah. So it's more like the slow, agonizing realization that the rules you were taught to follow don't actually apply to the people who made them. And it's watching systems that technically still function, like, you know, the post office or the healthcare system, government, but they feel morally bankrupt. They're just going through the motions until the power finally gets cut. And you get this feeling of being gaslit by reality because you're told that the economy is supposedly strong while you're looking at a small bag of groceries that cost $40 and contains four apples and a couple boxes of cereal. You're told that society is progressing while everyone you know is pretty much one bad week away from a nervous breakdown or an eviction notice. So the fourth turning is when the great fake stops working. In the summer of a cycle, think the 1960s and 1970s, society was busy arguing about values. In the fall, which would be the 80s and the 90s, we were busy pretending those arguments didn't matter because we were all getting rich or at least buying a bunch of stuff on credit. But winter is when the credit card is maxed out and the furnace starts making the clicking sound. That means it's about to explode or just die. So the rules stop making sense in a fourth turning. You start to see that the people in charge aren't actually in charge. They're just the ones who happen to be standing near the microphone when the music stopped. And there's a total loss of trust across the board. And it's not just in the government, but in each other. And this is when we start to look at our neighbors like they're the reason the furnace is broken. So this is a time of extreme polarization. And it isn't necessarily because we actually disagree on everything. It's because when a house is freezing, everyone starts fighting over the last blanket. All right. So if this 80-year block is a season, then every season has a starting point. A first frost, so to speak. And for us, that was probably arguably 2008, though you could probably say that it was 9/11, 2001. Either way, I know that feels like ancient history in internet years. So if 2001 was the initial crack in the windshield, 2008 is where the crack expanded. You know how that goes. Some random tiny pebble hits the glass and just leaves a little spot, and for a while you just ignore it. Then you think, yeah, I can still see the road. It's all right. But then the temperature changes and you hit a pothole, and suddenly that tiny speck or starburst spans the entire view. And it becomes a much more serious issue. So 2008 was, I would say that was the moment when the social contract was taken out back and shot. This was the moment where we realized that if you're big enough, you can fail miserably and still get rewarded, get bailed out. But if you're too small, you can do everything right and still lose your home. That was more or less the catalyst, and that was the start of our winter. And since then, it's just been a steady escalation of the reveal. And that would be things like the pandemic, the supply chains breaking down, the populist rages, the rise of authoritarianism, wars that feel like they're being fought with 20th century maps and a 21st century drone. And none of these things are actually what caused the crisis. They're just the weather of a fourth turning. So if the windshield is already cracked, every bump in the road feels like the end of the world. We've spent the last 25 years or so watching the glass just spiderweb further and further out. And the most exhausting part is that we're still sitting in the passenger seat, screaming at the drunk driver, while the driver is just busy checking his reflection in the rearview mirror. We've reached a point where work doesn't equal security. Truth doesn't equal consequences. Facts are ignored. And authority figures don't even bother to lie well anymore. And they know that we know they're lying. They just don't care. That's a very fourth turning flavor of nihilism. Now, the weirdly comforting and deeply annoying thing is that we've been here before. Almost exactly 80 years apart, every single time. So, go back 80 years from 2008. And what do you find? 1929, the Great Depression. The lead up to World War II. That was the last fourth turning. The world felt like it was ending then too. And in some ways it certainly was. The old empires were collapsing. The economy was a ghost. And everyone was looking for some strong man to fix the furnace. It was a brutal, bloody winter, but it ended with a completely new world order. Now go back 80 years before that, and we're in the 1860s, which is, of course, the Civil War era. And this is where the nation literally tore itself in half because the old compromises didn't work anymore. And the institutional rot had become so bad that the only way forward was unfortunately through a slaughterhouse. Okay, so let's go back 80 years before that. And now we're in the 1770s, the American Revolution. So this is where a group of Enlightenment era people decided they'd rather risk a hangman's noose than keep paying taxes to some king that lived a 3-month boat ride away. Are you noticing the pattern here? Each of these periods felt like an apocalypse to the people living through them. Nobody in 1862 was sitting around thinking, oh, this is just a necessary phase of a saeculum. They were thinking, my cousin is trying to bayonet me and the world is on fire. These crises happen because human institutions are like milk. They have an expiration date. We build systems to solve the problems of the last crisis. But eventually what happens is those systems become the problem. They get top heavy, they get corrupt, and they get brittle. And then nature or history or whatever you want to call this collective madness comes along and it clears the forest floor so something else can grow. In nature, that's usually a forest fire. It's not really destiny. Apparently, this is human nature. And it's just what happens when you stop maintaining the building for 80 years. Naturally, eventually, the roof caves in. And right now, you can hear the wood creaking. So the real engine of these turnings, this whole 80-year cycle, it isn't some grand cosmic clock. It's us. And it's the constant infuriating churn of generations, each one born into a different season and carrying their own particular baggage and blind spots. So think of it like a play that gets restaged every 80 or so years, but with a new cast who never read the previous scripts. And right now, in this particular winter, the casting director really outdid themselves. It's a tragicomedy, really. First, you've got the boomers, or the prophets as elders. So these are the people who rode the wave of the last great societal rebuild. Lucky them. That was the post-World War II boom. And they had it all. The moral certainty, the endless idealism of youth and optimism. Of course, they had the financial prosperity, the upward mobility, and then the power of middle age. And now, well, they're the elders. And they're still fighting the culture wars of the 1960s. They're right about a lot of their civil rights era values. I'll give them that. But with all due respect, and of course, you know, this is a little bit of a generalization. This is not everyone. They're a little out of touch about everything else. They tend to still believe in the big idealistic answers and the grand solutions, which is again out of touch because it ignores the fact that they also spent 50 years or so installing most of the problems that we're dealing with now. Okay, and then you have Generation X, the nomads in midlife. That's my generation. So we grew up cynical, independent, and I guess you could say perpetually overlooked. We were the latchkey kids who figured out how to fix the TV ourselves because nobody else was around. And now we're the ones, for the most part, quietly holding the whole brittle structure together with duct tape and a deep, abiding sense of weary competence. We don't believe in salvation. We don't believe in grand movements. We just believe in survival. So we keep showing up, fully understanding the gravity of the situation. We do the job, and then we go home to ironically watch something terrible on screen, on streaming. Nobody expects anything from us, which is exactly how we like it. Okay. Next up, we have the millennials, the heroes in young adulthood, these poor souls. So the millennials were raised on a steady diet of participation trophies. You can be anything you want. Platitudes and, you know, the earnest optimism of the late 1990s. And then they were delivered, fresh out of college, straight into a burning building called the 2008 financial crisis. So they're the generation that got punched in the face the moment they walked out the door. And now they're burdened with student debt and a housing crisis and the crushing weight of having to fix all the things the previous generations broke. They seem to be weirdly earnest about trying to fix things, even though they're completely burned out. So they show up, they make a TikTok about their anxiety, and then they try to unionize. It's a whole vibe. All right, and finally, we've got the kids, I call them kids, Gen Z, the artists in youth. So these are the ones coming up right now. Now I understand there's Gen Alpha, but they're just too young as of yet. So Gen Z, you could say they're hyper aware, hyper anxious. They're emotionally literate in a way that makes the rest of us look like Neanderthals. They've grown up entirely online, watching the world burn in real time on a tiny screen. So they're the generation that will eventually, hopefully, build something gentler, something more authentic, if they can survive the absolute pressure cooker of a world that we've handed them. I guess you could see them as the canaries in the coal mine. And the coal mine is unfortunately currently on fire. So this whole generational dance is why these cycles are so persistent. Each generation brings its own flavor of hubris and blind spots, setting the stage for the next crisis. It's ultimately just human nature playing out on a multi-decade loop. So if we're deep in winter, in the winter of a fourth turning, if the systems are brittle and the trust is eroding faster than a sandcastle in a hurricane, then what comes next? Well, the theory points to something called a climax. Now, before you go stocking your bunker with canned beans and tactical flashlights, though honestly a good flashlight is always handy, let's define climax carefully here. It's not necessarily some Hollywood-style mushroom cloud in the sky type of event. It could be, but it also could be economic, political, technological, or an institutional collapse. And it could be, you know, one of these, something that's so profound that the old order simply cannot stand anymore. And that's actually at stake during this climax, you know, what's actually at stake during this climax. It isn't just money or power. It's legitimacy. And it's social trust. It's our shared reality. And it's the very notion that we can agree on basic facts and collectively decide on some way forward. You know, when a society loses its shared story and its common ground, that's when things get truly dangerous. Think of those previous climaxes, like the Revolutionary War, the Civil War, World War II. Now, those weren't just bad times. Those were periods where the very existence of the American experiment was on the line. They were moments of total societal reset, often forged in fire and blood. And the uncomfortable truth is, crises create both immense danger and immense possibility. That's what's at stake. So the same fire that burns away the rot and the deadwood is also the fire that can forge something incredibly strong and new. Steel gets harder in the heat. And look, understandably, no one wants a climax. No one wants to live through a history being made, especially when it feels like history is trying to make you into a statistic. But history, like an overzealous event planner, keeps scheduling these things. It's unavoidable. And us, being the current inhabitants, are stuck with the RSVP. So, the challenge here, the terrifying and exhilarating challenge, is what we choose to forge when the heat is at its highest. because the old way is clearly not working anymore. Now, before we all start wearing the end is nigh sandwich boards, let's take a deep breath. I'm a skeptic by nature, and maybe you are too. And if anyone tells you that they have some secret map of the future that works like clockwork, they're usually trying to sell you a subscription to something or to get you to join a cult. So the Strauss-Howe theory, which is where the turnings theory comes from, it does have its holes. History isn't a Swiss watch. It's more like a leaky faucet in a haunted house, which means that sometimes it drips perfectly in time, and sometimes the pipe just bursts and floods the basement for no reason at all. And critics will tell you, and they're not wrong, that this theory is a bit Procrustean, which is a fancy way of saying it tries to stretch or chop off the feet of history to make it fit into a specific bed. It focuses heavily on Anglo-American history, and it tends to ignore random black swan events like, a plague or a stray solar flare or whatever, you know, a massive volcano, some natural disaster, whatever. And those things, of course, don't care what season we're in. So the biggest danger of this kind of thinking is fatalism. If you believe the winter is inevitable, you might be tempted to just sit on your hands and wait for the collapse. Or you might start rooting for the fire, thinking that's the only way to get to spring. But I wouldn't recommend doing that, because this theory, it isn't destiny. It's more like a weather report. And you know how the weather can be. So if the report says there's a blizzard coming, you don't say, well, I guess I'll just freeze to death then. You go find some firewood. You check on your neighbors. You make some preparations, you know. You make sure you have a way to keep the lights on. The value isn't in the prophecy. The value is in the pattern recognition. So it's a tool to help us understand why everything feels so heavy right now. It's not that you're broken. It's that the environment you're living in is currently undergoing a massive structural shift. Now, I understand that knowing that doesn't fix the problem, but it stops you from losing your mind trying to figure out why the old ways aren't working anymore. So I guess the question is, how do you actually live through this without becoming a total shut-in or radicalized lunatic? Well, you don't win a fourth turning. You don't beat history. You endure it with some level of intelligence. And since I'm not going to do platitudes here, here's the cold, hard reality of what that looks like. First, prioritize local competency over global anxiety. So the only way you can try to remedy the institutional rot within the global banking system is how you spend your money or don't spend your money. You can't obviously entirely fix the policy from your couch, but you can decide which machine you're feeding and how much. So every dollar that you move out of a giant hollowed out institution and into a local skill or a small neighborhood business is a small act of sabotage against that system. It's about building a fortress out of things you can actually touch and trying to make sure that you actually know how to do something useful besides scroll. Can you fix a leak? Can you grow food? Do you know the names of the people on your block? Will you have each other's backs when the shit hits the fan? So in a winter phase, the supply chains of social trust break down. And your security isn't going to come from your 401k or a politician's promise. It'll come from being a person that other people in your immediate vicinity actually want to keep around. Okay. So the second thing I would consider, skill up and ego down. Now, we've spent decades chasing status metrics, titles, followers, the right kind of digital aesthetic. In a crisis, those things have the trade-in value of a used napkin. So real skills, tangible, physical, or highly cognitive ones are the only currency that doesn't devalue when the system glitches. So try to learn to be useful in a way that doesn't devalue when the system, does fall apart. Try to be useful in a way that doesn't require a high-speed internet connection. Now, the third thing I would try to do is just stop looking for a hero. One of the hallmarks of this phase is the desperate search for a strong man or some savior that we think is going to fix everything. And the reality is, history shows that those people usually just end up burning more of the house down to keep themselves warm. And we're going through that right now. The hero of the fourth turning isn't one guy on a stage. It's the boring, grueling work of small groups of people deciding to act with integrity when it would be easier to be a snake. So basically, stop asking why is it cold and start making sure that, you aren't the one who's out of matches. So I think there's actually a weird kind of peace that comes with realizing you're living through an ending. Most of our anxiety comes from trying to hold together things that are clearly falling apart. We're trying to grasp when we know deep down we have to just let go. And, we think that if we vote harder or tweet more or work more hours or whatever, we can somehow just stop the rot that's going on. But, we can't stop a season. We can't really stop this cycle. you can't negotiate with, I don't know, January. The system, it isn't really glitching, it's concluding. And once you accept that, you stop making the chaos, or you stop taking the chaos personally. And you realize that the crisis, it isn't a reflection of your own failure. It's just, this is the environment. And it's the atmosphere. And it's where you either adapt or you die. Winter, it feels like death because in many ways, it is an ending. But endings are the only thing that clear the space for anything new to happen. If old trees never fell, the forest would eventually starve for light. So this is our fourth turning. The institutions are hollow. The social contract is a shred of paper, and the air is getting a bit thin. You can spend your energy yelling at the clouds for being gray, or you can start figuring out how to keep your own fire going. And history doesn't care about your feelings, but it does care about your resilience. If this is a cycle, then probably the most sane thing you can do right now is stop asking why it's cold and start looking for the people that you want to sit by the fire with. Everything is breaking right now, and we're seeing it daily in real time. Fine, let it break. You can't stop it. But just make sure that you're standing under the chandelier when it drops. Well, I guess hopefully I'll see you in the spring. As always, thanks for listening.